Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may have a position in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation or the content of this podcast. Do your own research.
Welcome Judith McKenzie to the All Points West podcast. Judith is partner and head of Downing Fund Managers. She joined Downing in October 2009. Prior to that, Judith was a partner at Acuity Capital, managing AIM-quoted investments and a small-cap activist fund. Before Acuity, Judith spent 9 years as a senior investment manager with Aberdeen Asset Management, focusing on technology and media investments in both listed and private companies. Going back even further, she was a media and telecoms analyst at Brewin Dolphin for 4 years from 1997. Judith is also the chair of the Quoted Companies Alliance, the organization representing growth companies, and is an active member on boards both in the private and public arenas. In 2010, Judith founded Downing Fund Managers, the boutique investment arm of Downing LLP, the fast-growing fund manager with about 1.9 billion of assets under management. Welcome, Judith. Your funds invest mainly in small-cap growth companies and in both public and private assets with strong renewable credentials. If you could just give us a flavour of what do you look for when scoping out new investment opportunities?
It might be worth me separating the roles that I have, the hats that I have, I suppose. So I'm head of Downing Fund Managers, and that's, as you say, the fund management arm of Downing that's also a private equity business in its own right. So as part of that, what I've been doing is pulling together some pretty special and unique fund managers, and we've got different mandates under that banner. So I will answer the question in terms of what I look for when I'm looking for an investment in that AIM and microcap space, but it is worth remembering that the wider DFM, Downing Fund Manager business, is actually looking at a range of different solutions and mandates. I look for companies that can generate very roughly a 10% free cash flow yield and are quite niche in their own right. So that's the bit of spreadsheet work that we do and where the modelling comes in. But actually what we're looking for is businesses that have got a bit of a moat where they've got a defensible product or service that they offer to their client base. And that normally means that they can charge more for what they do. Normally means their margins are higher. And normally means the return on invested capital is pretty good as well. And you get a good return on invested capital, you go back to that cash flow point and hopefully you're generating a free cash flow yield of about 10%. But no doubt we'll come on and talk about it. We are investing in people. We're investing in management teams. So all the numbers can stack up, but also you've got to have a management team that you can have confidence can deliver it as well.
When you mention a moat and something defensible, presumably there you're talking about something that's got a higher barrier to entry and it isn't just freely available to everybody else.
Yeah, if it was easy, then everybody would do it. So yeah, we think it's quite difficult. I mean, we've got a great universe. So we're looking at AIM companies typically. So there are 633, to be precise, as of today, AIM companies that we can look at. I would say probably a third of those would be companies that might not be profitable, might not be in our market cap range, might be a little bit too small. So that narrows things down in its own way. And then you can start running the numbers and looking at the free cash flow yield. And then you're probably coming up with another sort of 50, 60 odd companies. And then you can really start drilling down. But to be honest, a lot of it is know-how and knowing, having spent 29, nearly 30 years investing in management teams in the AIM space, then you get to know the companies relatively well and you can start following management teams and boards as they go through their own life cycle. So it's a degree of the desk work and spreadsheet work combined with actually common sense. And you know, a lot of what we do is going out and kicking the tires of companies and seeing what they do and how they touch people's lives and what kind of uniqueness they really have. Ramsden's, which is a pawnbroker, but also sells jewellery and secondhand jewellery and sells FX. I can go into one of their stores in pretty much any town and get a feel as to how they're doing, what kind of jewellery they're selling, how that fits into their online model. So if we can actually get something tangible, we can go out and touch and feel and see it, it makes it even easier.
I read that you like to be pretty hands-on and get to know management. How would you describe your investment style?
Well, I mean, everybody likes buckets, don't they? But if you were to put us in a bucket, we'd say that we are value investors. Now, that's not the deep value where you're waiting for something to come of age and it could take years for it to happen. It's companies that are typically trading at a discount to our peer group. So our average PE is about 12 times, whereas some of our competitors in this space, our fund managers, would be investing round about double that in companies that are slightly larger market cap. Our average market cap in our service at the moment is 244 million. Again, our peer group are probably hunting slightly further up that market cap curve. But what we see is that we feel that we're doing something slightly different and unique because we're hunting where others aren't necessarily chasing stocks. Those stocks are actually cheaper than they would be if you go up market cap curve. And actually, there are fewer analysts covering them. And that might seem a little bit counterintuitive, but we love that market inefficiency where these companies might be a little bit unloved and why they're sitting at discounts to their peer group. But actually, if there's only two analysts or 1.8 of an analyst covering them, then that's a great opportunity. If we've got the time, as we do, to go out and kick the tires of these businesses, meet management team, interview boards, then we're going to find something that somebody else hasn't found. So that really is our investment philosophy. It's not to chase momentum. We are value investors. We know what we like when it comes to cash flow yields. We know that we like cash in the balance sheet. We like hard assets. And we don't want to overpay for them. It's really just as simple as that.
Yeah. It's quite tough at the value end there. You mentioned it might not be hugely profitable at the moment, but that can change pretty dramatically in a short space of time, can't it?
I maybe disagree, actually, because I think if you get a business that's relatively easy to understand, so it's not a high-tech business or something that you need to be a scientist to understand, and there's plenty of companies out there that are very simple and have been around for a while, then if you spend time with management and you ask them about what they think is going to happen with their margins, they can literally line by line take you through a factory and show you what efficiencies they might be able to build in. It will require a little bit of investment. And then you can put two and two together to see how a margin gets from, say, 3 or 4% to 10%. When you can break it down and see those component parts, actually, that's the nub of what we do. Now, we won't get the forecasting right for 3 years out. You know, we'd be lucky to get forecasting right for maybe the next 12 months to 24 months. Anything beyond that, even management don't get right. So I think, again, our USP is that we probably spend a bit more time than other people going through the absolute detail. We're not taking an analyst note. And yes, you never get it 100% right, but you can really get a good idea as to the direction of travel.
Yeah. You're winding down your microcap investment trust, and there are reports that you're closing your VT Downing listed infrastructure income fund. What's happened in both those instances?
Quite different, actually. So the listed infrastructure fund we launched probably a bit late, took longer than we thought to launch. So it was a bit of a tracker as well. So what it was doing, it was buying the 40-odd investment trusts that were in that infrastructure space. And if you cast your mind back to last year, the trust effect, etc., what's happened, obviously, is that interest rates have gone up and equity income has been pretty unpopular. So this was really a play on capturing and tracking that infrastructure space that also had a really decent yield. And as you've seen from some of the infrastructure investment trusts, they've gone to quite significant discounts, you know, up to sort of 20-odd%. And what we were finding was that people wanted to invest in bank accounts and yielding what they perceived as safe assets as opposed to infrastructure. Yeah. So I think our timing was pretty poor there. And you have to get lucky in these things as well. So we just called it a day on that one. And I think it's better to not have something that's subscale that you know is likely to be subscale for a long period of time. So I think you've done the right thing by investors there. DSM, the investment trust, a bit of a different story and really a victim of probably two things. It's been now 7 years since it was launched and we probably launched it at the peak, the heyday of the small cap market, and fund allocators are really not looking at anything under 100 million market cap for investment trust. And we were sitting at 35 to 40 and really struggling to get it up. And it felt like the right thing to do, not just to sit there and carry on with things, but We had a good number of takeouts last year at decent premiums. So our cash level had gone up has gone up towards the tail end of last year. Well, you know, as managers, we felt the right thing to do was to start to return that capital to shareholders. And we should be able to get maximum value for the companies in the portfolio now. I think there will be further takeouts already in the portfolio. A couple are under strategic review. And hopefully we'll get a little bit more impetus behind small cap markets in that time as well. So, yeah, sad to do it. It probably also allows us to concentrate on our AIM IHT assets that have really been growing.
Yeah. You say IHT, this is inheritance tax planning, is that?
Yes, yeah. Inheritance tax product, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So some background here for our listeners. Downing has been managing AIM portfolios since March 2012. Recorded growth of 141% compared with the benchmark of around 5%. And you've got about 151 million of the 1.9 billion assets under management invested in AIM. So you're a pretty significant investor. From an investment manager's point of view, what are the challenges facing AIM at present and how do we fix that?
How do we fix that? So I mentioned that there are 633 companies on AIM. Go back 5 years, that would be over 2,000. So that's things going in the wrong direction.
What's contributed to that, do you think?
Well, you know, I was speaking to a US investor who dabbles on AIM just about middle of last year, and he just laughed. And it was awful, actually. He just laughed and said, well, you know, the UK is just regarded as being toxic. And it's just the saddest thing to hear. You know, we've got some great companies that we need to be shouting about. We've actually got quite a good mechanism through our London Stock Exchange and AIM and the other platforms that we've got. So I think we've got lots to shout about, but we've been really bad. The UK pension funds, UK investors have been, apart from private investors, have been really poor at allocating to UK companies. Yeah. And why is that? You know, growth has been a little bit stagnant in the UK, but you look at our portfolio in our AIM IHT and we are forecasting 19% growth over the next couple of years in that portfolio. So you can find growth companies. I think we've been bad at marketing ourselves pretty broadly. There has also been a few little hiccups. So the perception is that governance is poor. Actually, governance isn't bad. And the governance code that QCA, the Quoted Companies Alliance governance code, that's now been refreshed, that gives some really good guidelines. And the majority of companies follow that. You're always going to get some bad eggs. So I think It's a combination of all of those things. But you look at the number of takeovers in the last 12 months. So other countries, other trade buyers, private equity are finding the value in our UK smaller companies, but we're not yet. We need more buyers than sellers. And I think what can be done to change that is a lot of the higher profile work that the QCA is doing. And that is calling for the pension funds to invest in UK smaller companies, which has already been muted by the Mansion House reforms, which is good. Now, it's going to take both parties to actually stand up and shout for UK smaller companies and growth companies. But actually now I think it's so fundamental for them to do so that they can't avoid.
Yeah. You said there that you were keen not to delve into the politics too much, but what has been the impact of Brexit, would you say, on the AIM market?
I think it's not necessarily AIM itself. I think it's probably been wider from that perception point. It's, if the headlines are all the time that the UK is terrible and everyone's going to the US market and London's dead, then actually that's what companies that are private start to believe. Yeah. And it becomes a little bit self-prophesying as well. So it's about changing that narrative as well.
Judith, can I take you back to the beginning now? Where did you grow up and what was that like?
I was lucky to grow up in the Northern Highlands, north of Inverness, in a very small village called Bewley. Well, not actually in the village, outside the village, so very, quite remote. But it gave me the freedom to go outside and muck about and do all the things that kids are supposed to do. I don't think I saw anything resembling a phone or any kind of electronic device until I was in my teens. So yeah, it was a great upbringing.
What did your parents do?
So they were entrepreneurs actually in their own right. They owned a couple of businesses in the local village in Bewley that I was drafted into at an early age. I think I was put to work around about 5 or 6, which made me never want to go into retail.
Have you got siblings?
Yeah, I've got one sister, a year and a half older, and went away for a good number of years and then back up to Inverness, close to Bewley about 7 or 8 years ago, and actually very close to where my sister is as well. So right. It's nice to be back in the fold.
Yeah. What were the values that you were taught, would you say, growing up?
I think my parents just had an ethos of working hard, and if you work hard, you reap the rewards for it. So I think that work ethic, maybe kind of Scottish Presbyterian, Northern Presbyterian work ethic was drilled in at an early age. And actually, I enjoy work. I get out of bed in the morning and I love the people that I work with, and I would do this job even if I didn't get paid for it. So I think being able to find something that you like doing that's not a chore was something that my parents definitely guided me towards.
What were you like at school? What subjects did you enjoy?
I would say early doors, not that great an attention to work after just what I've said, maybe contrary. So I would be looking to do anything else apart from sit down and do homework or whatever. But actually, I suppose I was drawn to analytical detective work, which now translates to where I am in my career. I liked English and I liked history. Normally, you'd have that bucketed into one set of metrics, but I really liked understanding how businesses worked, maybe driven by my parents. And that led to being quite interested in economics and that side of things, and obviously math because of that.
Yeah. And then after school, did you go to university, and where did you go? What did you study?
I initially wanted to be a business-related journalist. I signed up to do Gaelic studies because I thought I could be a Gaelic journalist, and Scottish anthropology, and then sort of realised that that wasn't necessarily going to be quite a wide enough market. So fell into economics and finance. And I was lucky enough, when I was in my third year, I think, I took a year out in industry. And I think I got the best job that there was at that point. And that really shaped the rest of my career, actually. And that was a 10-month job with a business called Ally Provincial, which was a corporate finance house for UK smaller companies. It's now morphed into something else. But I was literally the bag carrier making the coffee for some pretty senior people within that corporate finance team. And I got to see deals getting done. I got to see small companies making acquisitions. I got to work on some of the documentation for it, but I also got to go out into the field, go around their warehouses and see how these companies worked. And I think the lights came on at that point. I really realised that that's what I wanted to be in the world of smaller companies, where I could have an influence, whether as an investor or advising them. That changed the course of everything.
So then what did you do then after university? Did you travel or did you jump straight into work?
No, straight into work. I was writing letters before I'd even graduated. When I'd been on placement, I'd done an exam called the Regi-Rep, which basically meant that I could ironically give advice to private clients. So I used that as the tool to get myself in the door of I was quite picky, of stockbroking firms. I think at that point I wanted to be an analyst in the private client side of things. And I did join a firm called Sterling Hendry for about a year and a half, but I realised that I really wanted to be on the analytical side while I was there. But actually, the team that I'd worked with at Allied Provincial had moved to Broon Dolphin, and they needed an analyst to come and join them, so they phoned me up, and again, I just went and jumped ship to them. So that really was the start of the career.
What was it that kind of first attracted you into that world of finance?
I think it's because I was nosy as much as anything else. You've got a bit of a pink ticket to ask questions. And the job that we do allows you to ask the questions and get to the heart of things. And I suppose that's why I maybe switched from going down that journalist route into finance.
When I worked for newspapers, I used to love a factory visit, and people used to think I was mad. But I think for the same reasons as you've just articulated there, you know, you get to see stuff happening in front of you, and you've got management with you. You can ask them whatever questions you want. Hopefully at the end of the visit, you've got a better understanding of the operation and you're able to write about it with a bit more authority in the end.
Absolutely. That's where you get your nuggets of information that other people don't have, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Which one of your previous jobs has had the biggest influence on you and your career, would you say, and why? You spent a long time at Aberdeen. I would imagine that was probably quite influential.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they've all had a different influence, a different way. You know, the early ones, kind of formulated my thoughts on how to make investments and what kind of investment style I liked. Aberdeen was great because there was a great degree of freedom that I had. I was investing in private companies, so maybe coming out of university, and also investing in AIM companies or USM companies as it was at that time. So I could see both sides of the fence, and I was getting the chance to fill my toolbox with the diligence techniques that a venture capitalist might use. And then at the same time, I was getting to learn about how the market worked. So that probably formulated where I am today as much as any other job that I had through those 9 years it was.
Yeah. You've been at Downing now for 14 and a half years. What is it that you most enjoy about it?
I like the people, plain and simply. And, you know, going back to what I wanted to do and formulate, I pitched up with a little business plan to Downing. I'd known them for years, knew the people for years and years, and said, look, you know, I'll help you out with your VCTs if you let me create a fund management business and start off with micro cap and small cap and stem it from there. And they let me get on and do it. And I do remember Nick Lewis saying to me, well, we'll give you enough rope to hang yourself, which I think was a compliment or not quite sure. But I was definitely allowed to try and hang myself and nearly did a few times.
Yeah.
But yeah, here we are now 14 and a half years later with some great fund managers under our banner. And I think that's probably what I'm most proud of. We've got some really good managers who we've given the platform to run their own mandates. Not only do they own a chunk of their own funds and are investors themselves, but they really believe in their mandates. And we're not like a big house. I'm not a CIO. I'm not telling anybody what macro view to take. These are intelligent people who have got the right controls wrapped round about them to get on with their day job. And hearing and seeing that in motion is great.
Yeah. What do you like to do outside work in order to relax, or any particular hobbies that you might have?
Oh, I've got a death wish. So I'm an eventer. My poor husband, that's all I can say. You know, we've got facilities here and horses and everything else. And he spends his weekends in a Land Rover with me going off to some godforsaken fields in the middle of nowhere and then waiting for me to fall off. So yeah, it's a switch off from fund management, that's for sure. Yeah. And I like getting out of the hills. That's why we live where we do. You know, getting out with the dogs up a hill, up a mountain on our back door is a great escape. But it's also a fantastic time to reflect on the businesses that you've maybe seen during the week as well.
Yeah, absolutely. If you could go back in time, what piece of advice would you give to a young Judith just starting out?
I think, you know, everybody's got that self-doubt when they start out. And you maybe always lose a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, where you think that the people that you're working with must be more intelligent and better educated and know what they're doing. I think, not naming names, but I probably worked with a few people where I was in awe of them, when actually, if I'd had a bit more confidence, I could have done maybe a lot better faster. So yeah, it's about having confidence and a bit of self-belief without being arrogant.
Yeah, that imposter syndrome is real, isn't it? Particularly when you're younger, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
Judith McKenzie of Downing, thank you very much for your time and for joining me on the All Points West podcast. I wish you all the best with it.
Thank you.